I'm encountering this issue a lot with film as well. Mm. Like, I'm trying to broaden my vocabulary of, like, what is the canon of film? And a lot of the canon of film, I'm like, I disagree. It's just not for me. And it's, like, it's really interesting to compare the work that's held up as canon versus the work that really resonates with me. And, like, the true path, I feel, is to dig into what really resonates with me. But
yeah, yeah.
It's still...
someone decided...
Yeah.
A person decided what was quote-unquote canon.
Yeah.
And they had their perspective.
I think that, like, time is a factor, too, though. Like, people don't consider... Like, something may be working in that time period, but, like, as you move forward in time, like, suddenly, like, values change, and suddenly it just doesn't hold up the same way. Like, I actually didn't watch Rocky for... years and years and years and years. Like, I finally was like, oh, it's this seminal movie. I should watch Rocky. And by the time I watched Rocky in 2017. And, like, you watch Rocky in 2017, you're like, what a horrible person. He's, like, abuses this. Why is Adrian putting up with this garbage? Like, she's putting in all this emotional labor to this, like, awful person who's, like, mistreating her. Like, it just doesn't work. But I'm sure, like, back in the 70s, it was like... no one is thinking about the gender politics. They're just like, wow.
An amazing romance.
What I mean, it is a good underdog story, and it was probably one of the first underdog stories, but, you know, times change.
Well, that and also, I think, sometimes a story will be, like, something about a story, the format or tropes or something will be copied by every story that comes after. Mm-hmm. And so if you've seen everything that comes after, and then you go back and watch the original, unless someone, like... drops in out of a helicopter to say, hey, this was the first movie to do that. If you don't know that, then it's like, oh, I've seen this before.
Yeah. No, there's two things that I've watched recently that fall into that category. Like, Casablanca is one that's just like, I still think it holds up. It's an interesting film.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty solid, but just the volume of references that have been pulled out of that work are really bewildering.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. And Evangelion is another one where I rewatched it recently and then, like, revisiting it with a lens of, like, the things that have come in the 20 years since Evangelion and all the things that was like, Eva did that first, or Eva evolved this in such a profound way that's now just referenced super, super widely and paid homage to in all of these other new cartoons.
I still need to watch that.
It's good. It holds up.
I'm such a big fan of Evangelion memes.
Oh, man.
They're my favorite memes, and I haven't even seen it.
You got to.
I know.
It's on Netflix now.
Is it?
Yeah, it's coming, I think. And it's the OG Eva.
Oh, okay.
Remastered or something.
All right.
I don't know. It's worth it.
I'll admit I need to catch up on Eva, too.
Welcome, everybody, to The Trade Waiters. We read the Calvin and Hobbes 10th Anniversary Book by Bill Watterson. So, I mean, if you've read some Calvin and Hobbes, you can continue to listen to this episode because there'll be lots we can talk about. There's, like, not a lot of spoilers in Calvin and Hobbes.
No, yeah, be gentle with me. I only read the first half of the book. I'm assuming the dad did it.
But... Oh, well, let me tell you. It was the mom the whole time.
What?
But, like, we're going to probably make reference to a few things that are specific to this edition, but I don't know, whatever. Calvin and Hobbes, everyone's read to that, right? Yeah. I assume. Yeah.
Well, this is part of the thing that I want to discuss, and we can get into that later on. Of, like, but, yeah, Calvin and Hobbes, woo!
Yeah, I'm really happy that we're doing this book. I was already telling Jonathan before we recorded that I was the biggest Calvin Hobbes fan as a child, and this has reminded me, like, how great this series is. I was so pleased to read this again.
Okay, let's jump in with a character-revealing question first, though, so you can find out who we all are and that none of us are imaginary. When you were a child, did you have a favorite toy that you either had the most imagination built around, or something that you just took with you everywhere? And if so, what was it?
This is how much I trust you guys. I guess all our listeners too.
It's just the three of us. Yeah. No one else is listening.
This will never get out into the public. My name's Jeff Ellis, first of all. And as a child, I had a blue bear that I named, I don't know, when I was maybe 3 years old. I don't even know how I came across this, but the name of this bear was Sister Gucci. That was the name of my bear. And I had that bear with me all the time. And I still have that bear on a shelf in my apartment right now, with several other plush animals sort of to camouflage it. But yeah, I still have my childhood bear. And we went on adventures. I had a very Hobbes-esque relationship with this teddy bear.
So
when I was very young.
What you're saying is one of us could steal that bear and hold it ransom for 25 cents.
Yes. And I would have to then steal your toy.
My name is Jam, and I had several stuffed animals that really meant a lot to me when I was young. I clicked a lot more with stuffed animals than any other type of toy. One that really stood out in my memory is a squirrel puppet. So it was actually like a puppet, and the name now eludes me, but I definitely had this squirrel puppet everywhere I went, and it was... I would, like, make it talk, and, you know, like, I would... It was a character. It was, like, a feature in our lives. And the other one, which was really important to me, was a red elephant named Anna. And it was just, like, a velvety red elephant that was, like, the most comforting toy that I had. And I carried that with me through university, and I think I still have it, but I haven't seen it in a while. I should figure that out.
Okay. I'm Jonathan, and I had quite a few puppets when I was a kid, and I was kind of a weird kid. I was always, like, inventing characters and coming up with stories, and nothing ever came with those. But
that doesn't sound like you at all.
No,
Jonathan.
I know. Totally different person now. But my mom would sometimes make these characters into things.
Oh.
Some of my Halloween costumes as a kid were characters that I had to explain to every single person I met.
Wow.
Which I was, of course, happy to do. And I kind of think maybe that was the point. I had a puppet that was a character of mine called Junk Devil, which was a orange, fluffy monster that lived in a junkyard. There was a whole species of Junk Devils, but this was the main one. And I took this puppet with me everywhere. I took it to bed with me every night. Eventually, it got so worn out that it had to be replaced, but it had to be replaced with another Junk Devil. And then my mom came up with an elaborate scenario that it was the same one, which I don't think I actually believe, but I was willing to accept that. I'm sure I still have Junk Devil somewhere, but I don't know where.
I want to see a comic about Junk Devil.
No. I've got better characters now. More interesting ones. So, we can talk a little bit about Bill Watterson, but honestly, there's not a lot to talk about because he is very much offline. Yeah. And, like, not much is known. I went and I read the Wikipedia article about him, and half of what was in that article was stuff that was, like, quotes from him from this book.
Wow.
A mystery wrapped in a conundrum.
Which is, I think, the way he likes it. He's from a small town called Chagrin Falls, Ohio, which he still lives in. Calvin and Hobbes is the thing he's most well known for, which ran in newspapers from 1985 to 1995. And before that, he worked briefly doing political cartoons for the Cincinnati Post, but he said that he... like, didn't really know enough about local politics for that to be viable, so they fired him. He also worked for a little bit in advertising and as an illustrator, but by far the thing everybody knows him for is Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes has won basically every award. It's won multiple Eisners, multiple Harveys, multiple Angoulême Awards, and he has some very strong opinions about how his work is used, which I'm sure will come up when we talk about this book.
Yeah.
I don't know, first impressions, which are probably not actually first impressions, of Calvin and Hobbes.
as I mentioned already, this is my second time, well, probably my 10th time reading this specific volume, the 10th anniversary book. I got this book when it first came out. I was super excited. I've basically been reading Calvin Hobbes for my earliest reading memory, because it was 1985. I feel like, and I could be wrong, but I almost feel like in 1985, when I was 5 years old, my mom was like, hey, there's this comic in the newspaper about a boy with an imagination. It's like you. And I'd be like, let's see about that. And then it was my favorite comic for forever. And I bought all the collections that came out through Scholastic. And I copied a lot of the things Calvin did. I had a cardboard box that was my time machine. And I mean, I would just totally take ideas from Calvin Hobbes and just act them out. And this book was a big deal to me because I think at this point, this was published, when was this, like 1992 or 93?
Yeah, like this book was published in 1995, I think.
Oh, that's it, yeah. So I was a teenager by then.
Okay.
And so I'd grown up reading Calvin when I was a child, and now I'm a teenager who's an aspiring cartoonist reading this book. And of course, the first chapter deals with his struggles with the newspaper comics industry. And I remember vividly being at a family gathering and a family friend saying, oh, hey, Jeff, like, you're drawing comics. Maybe you'll be in the newspaper someday. And I remember being a, like, snarky 15-year-old being like, oh, well, actually, let me tell you about the newspaper comics, and telling him way more information than he wanted to know. And in hindsight, I forget who that was, but whoever it was, I'm very sorry about that. I was a snarky teenager. You didn't deserve that. This was great to reread. And I'd actually forgotten that the essay at the beginning was actually so short. My memory was that like half this book was his essay, but it's actually delightful that most of this was just random comics that he pulled in. And the other thing I'd forgotten is I enjoyed that some of the comics he references, like he has little plates of the comics with notes, and some of the comics you read the comic and then the note is like, I didn't like this comic very much, I didn't think it worked. And I sort of enjoy the fact that he's not just showcasing what he thinks is his best work, he's also showcasing what he thinks are his failures, even though like I'm like, you didn't like that, Bill, because still a good comic, but yeah, anyways, this was great. I'm gonna stop gushing and let someone else talk.
I think I have a different experience of Calvin and Hobbes. It's interesting that we just had a conversation about canon, right? I do think that Calvin and Hobbes is unequivocally and inarguably a major part of North American comics canon. And I think that is a title that it inarguably deserves. Like, it is a really strong comic. It was a groundbreaking comic at the time. It continues to be a comic that sets the high watermark for a lot of, let's call it, strip style cartooning. Like, I can't think of a Gagatay that has come anywhere close to what Calvin and Hobbes achieved. And I think the work in it of itself stands alone. I'm glad that there are easy and accessible ways that you can access this work, right? You know, like, it's easier to get to and experience it. It did make me very nostalgic for comics as an experience in the newspaper. However, like, when I reflect on that experience, Calvin and Hobbes wasn't the one that stood out within the newspaper. And I think that's just an artifact of the fact that I am slightly younger than you. So, like, it's really interesting that the publication years are 85 to 95. And I think that time period is going to intersect with different people very differently. So I was born in 84. So I didn't really get old enough, I think, to appreciate the humor of Calvin and Hobbes until the tail end of the series. When I was young, I really resonated much more with... My favorite one was Garfield, which isn't the better comic. Like,
no, but I feel like for a lot of kids, like, I remember a period of time when Garfield was my favorite comic too. And there are still kids for whom that's their favorite newspaper comic.
Yeah. Right.
There's something about it that just resonates with a certain age.
I had a Garfield period too, guys. Yeah.
So it's like it was a little bit more simplistic, and that is the comic that really pulled me in. And it's like that was the one I was excited to read in the comics. I also really liked The Far Side and Real Life Adventures and like the more off-the-wall stuff for whatever reason. And I think those were the ones that resonated the most with my parents. And so I was kind of like teasing apart what was funny about this to my parents. And it wasn't until later on that I came to appreciate Calvin and Hobbes and how different it was from the other strips on the paper and how beautiful and important it was because of that. So it's like I don't have the same kind of nostalgia angle to it, but Calvin and Hobbes is just like unequivocally an amazing comic and really a joy to read. Like the cartooning in this strip is so fun and so funny and just, it just feels effortlessly beautiful. And it's like, of course it's not effortless, but it's incredible. Like what Bill Watterson can portray in just a couple of simple gestures. And I will never understand, like, he looks like someone who has probably, the comics in this strip look like someone who has been cartooning for his entire life. And yet he came out of the blue and then left as quickly. It's just bewildering. It's weird.
I think
this is really interesting, actually, because I'm a little bit older than Jeff. And so I don't feel as strongly about Calvin and Hobbes as I think he does. Because I was a little older when it started. And when it finished, I was graduating from high school. That was the year I graduated from high school. So at that point, I wasn't reading the newspaper, for sure. I was on to other things. I was reading X-Men. But, so yeah, I mean, I was around to see all of these comics in the newspaper, and I definitely liked them. They were probably my favorite newspaper comic during those 10 years, like after my Garfield phase. And I know that kids still read these comics because these volumes have never been out of print. But I don't know that they have as much impact now as they did, because you can only get them in these volumes. They're not, I don't think they're in the newspaper. And if they are, they're not new.
Calvin and Hobbes certainly isn't in the newspaper anymore.
Yeah. So it's more of a rarefied phenomenon now rather than being a thing that everyone has seen as it was while it was running in the newspaper. And like when I was doing the research for this, I was actually shocked that it had only run for 10 years, because it sure didn't feel like 10 years worth of impact. It felt like more than that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's sort of like, I feel like Calvin and Hobbes has been with me my whole life, which, you know, was,
well, for you, it portion, was
a significant portion of it. But, you know, it's like, the 10 years, you, like, it's interesting reading this, too, because I think I read this as being his sort of goodbye letter, but he keeps talking about the comic in the present tense in the book, and he even sort of talks about, like, moving forward, like, at the end, it sort of feels almost like, no, I'm going to still make some more comics, but I'm like, I'm pretty sure, like, after this book, he was like, bye. Like,
it's weird.
Well, they must have been at about the same time. Like, maybe he hadn't yet decided to retire. Mm-hmm. When he was writing the passages that are in this book. It was published in 95, but that doesn't mean that's when he wrote this.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What do you think makes Calvin and Hobbes so special?
I'm going to say that I think it's just the incredible level of skill, both in the writing and in the art. Nothing else in the newspaper for decades, at least, has had this level of craft. It was interesting rereading this. Like, I'm the one who picked this book, and I picked it because I knew it had this essay at the start and would have things to talk about. But I feel like as full of craft as this is, as incredibly skilled as this is, it's like, I feel like you could do more with comics if you weren't given the constraints of a newspaper. And the fact that he was able to pull this off with those constraints is remarkable. But I think it shows its age a little bit.
Interesting.
I mean, I was going to say, I sort of feel like maybe part of the success of Calvin and Hobbes is just the way it's a success in premise, because he establishes a very simple premise. You have a boy with a tiger that talks to him, possibly imaginary, possibly not. And I actually enjoy in the writing here where he goes out of his way to not define that relationship. Like, you can look at it as it's an imaginary friend, or you can look at it as it's a tiger that comes to life when no one else is around. I'm not going to answer that question for you. And I think that almost is at the root of why Calvin and Hobbes work so well, because he makes this world that's so simple with like a boy and his tiger and his mom and his dad, and then everything else is a lot more amorphous. Like, he doesn't give the parents names. He doesn't do a lot of very specific settings. Like, yes, Calvin goes to school, but you don't see a lot of the school. He lives where he has this giant forest in his backyard, so a lot of these adventures he's just out in the woods. Like, you don't have a lot of specificity, and so because nothing's very specific, it feels very timeless. And then he has this great premise of this boy with a overactive imagination, so at any point he can shift gears. So we can have just Calvin having a water balloon fight, and then we can have like Tracer Bullet crime noir, and then we can have Spaceman Spiff, and then we can have a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and then we can just do like a story about his dad like riding his bike on the weekend. Like, and all of that works and fits within the framework of the universe and doesn't feel jarring. Like, mm-hmm. And it's broad enough that all of that can fit inside of it, and you can tell all these different stories and it still feels like it's part of the same universe.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you've both hit on some really interesting things that make this work so compelling and so... And I agree with you, John. I don't think it's 100% timeless, but it is, like, still seminal.
Yes,
let's put it that way. Like,
absolutely.
Even looking back 20 years later, it still is a remarkably seminal work and, like, has had so much impact in comics. I think... I agree with the fact that it is just at such a high level that it just is a feat that has not been repeated. Mm. It's kind of like he set an Olympic world record that no one has been able to match for over 20 years. If you think of it that way, right? Like, in terms of the constraints, physically just needing to write and produce on that schedule, like the physical constraints are, he's like the Miyazaki of strip cartoons, right?
Mm.
If you think about it that way. But when I reflect on this work and, like, why was it so timeless and why was it so broadly resonating, and it's like, I don't think it actually is, it's not a realistic portrayal of a boy in his imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And when I reflect on Calvin and Hobbes, it's more as if it is a reflection of the inner child.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like an adult's inner child, because Calvin's observations, like, he seems, like, way more put upon in life than a regular kid
right.
to me, you know, like right. he rebels against the drudgery, and he feels like I do sitting in my office doing something that I don't want to do,
huh.
more than how I reflect on the experience of being a child, right? And I feel like Richard Thompson does a better job of capturing the feeling of what it's like to be a kid, where like everything is confusing and you're kind of powerless. Whereas Calvin feels a bit detached, and it's more like a broad commentary on life.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe like I think it kind of, to go back to the whole idea of Hobbes not being defined, I feel like maybe that is what's at the core of Calvin and Hobbes, is that it's about a little boy, but it's not about a little boy. It's like, I think to say that it's a boy, I mean, sorry, and I just said this, but like when I say it's a boy with an overactive imagination, I almost feel like that's doing it a disservice, that it's this sort of, these characters in a fantastical place where sometimes we deal with the drudgery of the real world and sometimes we're somewhere else. Like,
here's a thought. What's interesting about Calvin and Hobbes is not only that it has this layer to it, but how well that layer has connected with people.
Mm.
So, for example, like, compare it to something like Peanuts. Peanuts also has a layer. Peanuts has a lot of melancholy and, lot of complexity to it. But if you talk to people about Peanuts, they're just like, oh, man, I just love Snoopy.
Right.
Just love that dog. He's so mischievous. And like the additional layer didn't really connect with people, but I think it's not true of Calvin and Hobbes.
Yeah. No, I do feel like Peanuts is trying to do the same thing, where the children are kind of an avatar of adults, and it's set in this context just to sort of make the story possible, because nobody wants to read about, Charlie Brown going to work at an office. it's much more visually interesting if he's trying to play baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and the character of Calvin, because he's really the only character, maybe Hobbes as well, but I feel like the strip is very centric on that character on purpose. Like, every other character only exists to serve the function of building up Calvin as a character and what he's going through. That character is maybe easier to connect to than Charlie Brown.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there's something in Calvin that, like I said, similar to the inner child we all hope to reconnect with.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
This kind of spunk.
And yeah, maybe, like, Charlie Brown's just too melancholy for us to be able to see ourselves in him,
mm-hmm.
unless you're in the right mood.
I think that maybe part of the success with the depiction of Calvin is that Calvin's got a lot of layers, right? Like there will be a strip where Calvin's like making a duplicate of himself so that he can like have someone basically be an indentured servant so he doesn't have to clean his room or go to school. But then in the process of that storyline, it's like he has to confront what a jerk he is. And, you know, it's like they'll have a lot of these stories, like he'll be having a meeting of gross and like harassing poor Susie, but then they'll have like a strip about like him coming across like a dead raccoon and like having to deal with ideas of mortality. And it's like, I just think that Calvin kind of runs the gamut. Like, you see Calvin at his best and at his worst. And I think it kind of, as far as like the reader maybe imprinting or seeing things in themselves in the reading of it, it's like Calvin is such a, like, he's not good, he's not bad, he's just a person. And I think that maybe adds to the relatability, as you can kind of like latch on to the different aspects of Calvin that resonate with you. And he's such a complex character that he has lots of aspects that you can latch on to.
I wonder if him being so egocentric is part of what makes him relatable in a strange way, where his ego is so strong that it kind of envelops you, the reader, along with it. Because that's the one part of him that's like maybe the least realistic, is how egocentric he is. But it's also like, that's kind of your inner voice.
Yeah.
Where like my story about myself is about me.
And it's like, that's what I meant in terms of wanting to be like Calvin. It's almost a part of wish fulfillment, right? Huh. It's like Calvin is the voice in your head. You know, like Calvin is the inner child that you have to continuously stamp down.
Mm-hmm.
And like seeing him live out what you want to do, like seeing him like create a box and 100 duplicates and like go on these adventures with his tiger and fly through the air in his wagon is just so freeing to read.
Yeah.
Mm. Or like, you know, like go to school and put on a costume and like write his test with his super intelligence and like then just walk out of the room, take the costume off and pretend like, no, that wasn't me. That was Stupendous Man. Like, it's sort of like we'd all love to do that, but we'd be so mortified by the outcomes we wouldn't. But it's like, it's like that wish fulfillment of like we think about doing stuff like that, but we just never bring ourselves around to actually doing it. And it's probably good that we don't. But
yeah,
it's like, that's kind of like living vicariously through Calvin.
Yeah, or this the one where he doesn't want to write the report. He slags off on the report for like the entire weekend and just like somehow gets away with it, you know? And it's like that resistance, that procrastination is like, he leans in so hard to it and is something that an adult would never get away with.
Yeah. But that initial like, ugh, this report, can't there be an easier way? Like, that's where we're all like, oh man, I know. And you read that comic, you're like, haha. But then we're like, well, okay, time to start that report where Calvin's like, bats or bugs?
talking about the craft side of things, I was consistently impressed with how much the strip never became formulaic.
Hmm.
Like, I don't have a lot of experience writing comedy, and I don't have a lot of experience writing really short comic strip-sized comics. I have been trying to do a little bit of that lately, which isn't anywhere you can see yet, but the fact that these strips can be so good without falling into repetition is, like, really impressive to me. Where, like, once in a while, there'll just be, like, a strip that is, like, nothing you've ever seen before, and you'll never see it again, and it's just, like, a single row of panels, and then there you go. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, rereading this with the notes, I just really appreciated his notes, where he would talk about, like, oh, you know, I tried introducing, like, an uncle character, but then I found it was limiting for these reasons, and so I abandoned it. Or, like, he'll be like, well, this particular story with the babysitter I thought worked really well for these reasons, and that's why I'm including it, and these other stories were weak for these reasons. And, you know, so I just really appreciated that he put a lot of thought into the crafting of each strip and into the writing. I just, it was like, I really appreciated just the amount of thought that he was putting into this series.
Yeah, it's a mystery to me how, like, I feel that the fact that Bill Watterson cares about the medium, about the craft of cartooning, I think, like, he cares so deeply. He cares maybe too deeply, but it really shines through in this work, right? And that's why it's so mysterious that he, like, appeared and then vanished, right? Yeah. It's Well, I think it's going to be a mystery that will reverberate through comics for many years to come.
Well, I mean, just even, like, I mean, this is one of my favorites, is the 160 here. Maybe I'll scan it, but, like, where it starts out, it looks like a Rex Morgan MD comic.
Oh, that was my favorite, yeah.
The joke is that it's him and Susie playing Doctor. And it's like the dialogue gets ridiculous with, like, it's like an adult man and an adult woman, but they're talking like children, and the woman's kicking the man in the shins, and then at the last panel is like, oh, it's just two kids pretending. But, like, he criticizes himself, saying, well, I didn't do a good job of drawing, like, those dramatic strips. But it's like, you look at this, like, he could have been doing it, right?
Yeah. He really is the Miyazaki of comic strips, if he's that self-critical.
I don't know. I would say, like, I find it interesting because, like, reading the letter at the beginning, which we should probably start talking about, but, like, you can tell he cares so much about the medium and the craft, except it seems like for him the medium is newspaper strips, period. And it's like, even I made a note to myself about, like, one of the strips near the back where Calvin is recapping a superhero comic to Hobbes, and essentially the joke is just that it's this hyper-violent comic with, like, sexually exploitive female superheroes, and, like, the note from Bill Watterson is just, like, you know, you can make your superhero a psychopath, you can draw gut-splattering violence, you can call it a graphic novel, but comic books are still incredibly stupid. And it just makes me so sad, because it's like he has all this passion for this medium that he's doing, and yet he doesn't see any potential in not doing a gag a day, and he derisively refers to the term graphic novel as if that's a bad thing. And it's like, to me, he's complaining about all the constraints that the newspaper syndicates put on him, and it's like, I don't want to take him aside and be like, hey man, you know what you do? Is you self-publish a graphic novel and you do whatever you want. So if you want to do full-page watercolor with poems, you could. Or you could do gag a day. Or, you know, like, it's like, as much as I respect his craft and his abilities and his passion, I do feel like it's really short-sighted of him that he sort of put comics in this little box and was like, nope, this is it. Like, if it doesn't fit in this box, it's not good anymore. I don't want anything to do with it.
Like, I feel like I can understand this if his perspective is the thing that newspaper comics do that nothing else does is, quote-unquote, everybody reads them. They show up in your newspaper, and then you have immediate access to them. You don't have to go out and find them. You don't have a niche audience. They're for everybody. They're the general public. And, like, that, maybe that's what he's getting out of it. But at the same time, I do feel like it's like, imagine being in 1995 and you're 20 years away from the graphic novel explosion, and then just deciding, well, newspapers aren't working, I'm going to quit. And then 20 years later, the graphic novel explosion happens, and like, well, too late, I quit, I'm done.
You know, it's a live your truth kind of situation.
Yeah.
Before we get into, sorry, finish your thought.
I was just going to say, and then just show up and do like three pages of Pearls Before Swine and then walk away again.
I mean, those are fantastic pages. Don't get me wrong.
Before we get into discussing the essay, which I think is the next logical place to go, I do want to express, hopefully I've made it clear that I have no beef with Calvin and Hobbes as a piece, but I do have beef with this book. Hmm. And I have beef with this book before I realized that it was published in 1995. So I came into this book kind of, you know, running through my day a little bit too busy. It's 2019. I'm like, we're going to do this book for the trade readers. Or, hey, whatever. Like, oh, it's just not available digitally. Right? And it's like, I'll get it on Amazon, right? And it comes into my door. It's in this gigantic package. And I'm like, what the F, right? And I open it. And it's this book, which you will see before you, right? And so I had it. The story of me is that I live in less than 800 square feet. So I have to be very selective. And I'm like, this doesn't even fit in my shelf. What is this book, right? And then I was like, okay, I get it. It has to be this big. This before even opening it, I go through this entire thought process. This book needs to be this big to have the Sunday comics, right? Put at a size of what they deserve. And right. Like, but if it's going to be this big, I wish it was a nicer edition. I wish it was a hardcover closer to the complete Calvin and Hobbes, which I also can't store in my apartment.
Right.
So then I thought, okay, well, obviously, because it's a floppy book, it's intended more for kids, right? You know, kids take it and they pass it around, and I think it's fantastic. Maybe I'll be able to give this book to one of my colleagues who has young kids, and they'll be able to experience Calvin and Hobbes finally. And then I open the book, and it has this essay.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, wait. This comic's not for kids. Really, like, this book is not for kids. What is this collection for? And it does seem to be, like, Bill Watterson's last attempt to express what he was trying to do to the adult readers of this comic.
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, before we go into that essay, the last thing I want to express is I think it's time for a new edition of Calvin and Hobbes so we can give it to the next generation. Mm. Kind of as he says in this essay, how important it is to have these collections to pass the canon on of these ephemeral newspaper strips. I don't think this is the best book to pass to these kids, even though they're obviously reading it. Let's check that out of the library. There's like 20 copies and all of them are in use.
That's right. Interesting. Like, I do feel like, again, I'm the one who picked this book.
Yeah.
But while I was reading it, I wish that I had skipped all the commentary and just read the comics and then maybe gone back and read the commentary after, because the comics are so good and the commentary is good for different reasons. And it's been so long since I last read Calvin and Hobbes that it was very jarring to sort of be taken in and taken out of this immersive world, to be like in the woods with Calvin, like rolling down a hill in a wagon, and then suddenly taken back out and like, oh, I didn't like this strip, it didn't work very well. It's like, I know that people will care about his commentary, I care about his commentary, but I would prefer if it was more separate.
And that's why I'm saying, like, maybe it's time for a new edition. Whereas like the commentary goes so deep into the minutiae of what it takes to create a newspaper strip, which from a craft of cartooning perspective is kind of an anachronism now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that no longer matters. And it's like, I wish there was something where you could just gently frame it for a young reader. This used to come to your door every single day and kind of like bringing to them the experience of, have you watched the documentary Stripped?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So like if you watch the documentary Stripped, it has this beautiful opening segment, which I feel really describes that experience to the viewer of like, oh, the comics are in the newspaper every day, and then just allow the comic to speak for itself. But yeah, that's the dream version of Calvin and Hobbes, which I don't know if it exists.
Well, I mean, I would just say that like of all the available Calvin and Hobbeses, we pick the one that is like the director's commentary version.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like, on me, I think.
Like,
it's okay.
I mean, sorry. And this is, I'll nerd out as the guy who grew up with Calvin Hobbes, because the Scholastic editions, like, they would have these little story arcs. So, like, Weirdos from Another Planet was just a linear, in order. You read all the black and white dailies, and then the Sunday strips were in order, and it was the story of Calvin going to Mars and meeting the Martians, and there was other storylines at the beginning and the end of that, right? And there's a linear progression in these books. And what's interesting to me is that I now, after reading this, I realize that when Calvin Hobbes was first being published, it was a square format where you'd have three dailies, one on top of the other. And then the Sunday editions were formatted more vertically. This is back when he wasn't allowed to do his own layouts. This is where he had to follow the newspaper grid. So the original books, they would restructure the Sundays to be vertical, and you'd have a more square format book. And those fit on a bookshelf. And then I remember as a kid when the next Scholastic came out and it was like this. And even as a child, I was like, what the hell do I do with this? It's all floppy. It's too long. It doesn't fit on my bookshelf. It's not hardcover, so it's getting curled. And that was just to suit what Bill Watterson thought was the better presentation of his work. And then when he put out the slipcase hardcover thing, it's just an enhanced version of this long, long thing that, yeah, it sticks 6 inches out of my bookshelf.
Yeah.
And like, it's just, I mean, it's beautiful in one regard, but it is also completely cumbersome, and it's nothing I could share with my nephew. So, see, now, when I bought the ultimate, I'm just going to call it the ultimate edition, the ultimate edition Calvin and Hobbes in the hardcover box, I still had all my individual Scholastics, and I gave those to my nephew.
Okay.
The one single that I didn't give was this one.
Okay, yeah, and that's why I'm saying, like, I think this is more for the adults.
I will say that those other editions, I believe they're also still in print.
Okay.
Those are still
like
around.
The essential Calvin and Hobbes. Yeah. Then there's a commentary in this of like, I named them arbitrarily.
Yeah.
So the complete is complete. The essential is maybe not essential. The indispensable is arbitrarily selected. Yeah. And, like, the arbitrary Calvin and Hobbes.
All right. So let's talk about some of the commentary. I have one specific question that maybe we can save till the end, unless it comes up earlier, but. Any thoughts on the process of working in newspaper comics and the process of Bill Watterson working in newspaper comics specifically?
Well, I would just say that if any young people are curious why nobody cares about newspaper comics anymore, this essay makes a pretty good case for why the newspaper strips suck now. Because, I mean, as a child, I remember when on Sunday, it was a big deal. Like, it was exciting. The newspaper would show up and your parents would pull out the separate booklet that had like a colored border. And there was a front page comic that was a full 8.5 by 11 page. And then every other page was two comics, one on top of the other. And it was like a little comic book. And it was an experience. And like, now it's like every comic is maybe 3 to 4 panels max, and they're like crammed around the Sudoku puzzle, and it's just sad now. Like the Sunday comics now. And reading this and reading like the fights he was having, like, I think the fact that he had to go to war to be allowed to lay out his page the way he felt like it, that's indicative of like a problem in your industry when you have a visual medium and you're forcing your artists to like fit this template so that they can like reconfigure the page to whatever suits like the print production. Like, that's a problem right off the bat, you know?
And it feels like it shouldn't have been a problem even in 1985, where, I mean, other types of comics in North America and the North American industry weren't doing that great. Like, superhero comics were kind of not that great. They were kind of trash and like no one read them. But at least if you were an artist working in that venue, no one would be telling you your page layouts.
Mm-hmm.
And this was like a new thing in newspapers too. Like if you go back even farther in newspaper comics, there weren't these kind of restrictions. Like artists could do all kinds of crazy things.
Well, I like that he references Winsor McCay and Crazy Cat, and if you ever look at those books, you're just like, oh wow, like those guys didn't have to follow a template.
Yeah, no, it's really true. It's like reading this essay, you can really tell, like, there is no... There isn't a set more poorly matched than Bill Watterson and the comic syndicates.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they just work... They're at complete odds, mm-hmm. right? They're just completely counter to each other's goals. And it's weird that... they had to come together to make this. Or, like, it's weird that... I'm trying to, like, phrase this thought. It's weird that Bill Watterson waded into this. That he was so stuck on the newspaper comic. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. as you mentioned later on, like, no, the newspaper comics is the comics. And he was, like, so stuck on that. And yet, like...
it was, like, not working out for him.
Yeah. It's, well, it's and, just
like,
weird it's
1980, like, he quits in 1995... He could have done, like, a web version of Calvin and Hobbes where he could have done any layout he felt like.
In 95?
Well, no, but, like, not in 95, but I'm saying, like, within about 5 years...
Yeah,
he, like, could have launched his own daily on the web and done whatever he felt like.
But he was also loaded after this, yeah, right? Yeah. After 10 years of doing Calvin and Hobbes, even without merchandising, he's set for life. Yeah. So, why? Right. I'm glad Bill Watterson is happy.
I think there's... I only meant in terms of, like, if the whole thing is I want to do my layouts the way I want to do them, it's like he was 5 years away from a point where he could have done whatever he felt like.
Except it wouldn't be in the newspaper.
That's right. I think that's got to be the key. I think he wants to do things for that audience. He doesn't want to do anything for any other audience. I mean, by 1995... the graphic novel scene was pretty small, but, like, Mouse was around. So, I mean, the potential was there. You could look at it and you could point to it and say, see, you could do what Art Spiegelman is doing. Like, there's potential there. And he was just like, no, that's not my audience. I can't do that.
Right.
I assume. Yeah. Like, I'm putting words in his mouth.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is like the part of me that's just like, I wish Bill Watterson was still making comics. But as you say, he's probably very happy watercoloring and just hanging out. And
I wish him the best.
Yeah, he's probably doing really well.
I will say, though, that I don't wish he was still making Calvin and Hobbes.
Mm.
I think for, like, the reasons he quit are mysterious. Like, he wrote a letter when he quit to say, I'm quitting, blah, blah, blah. And without a whole lot of explanation, basically, I've done what I can. My job is done. Thank you. Goodbye. Something like that. And I feel like far better to spend 10 years at the top of your game making an amazing comic that will last the centuries and to say, at some point I'm going to quit and I'm going to decide that time is now, than to do what so many other newspaper artists have done and just keep going for decade after decade after decade, to keep going when your hand shakes and you can't physically draw the comics anymore, or to pass it on to your children who used to be characters in the comic and now they're the one making the comic. Like, those are not recipes, as much as, like, these are incredibly talented people, I don't think that's the recipe for the best possible comic.
No, and I mean, Bill Watterson talks about it himself in here, which is, like, you need to let new cartoonists in or your industry stagnates. And it's like, I'm sure he would have been appalled to know that all the other comics that shared space around Calvin and Hobbes are still there. And so he made space for one comic and everyone else is still just hanging in there.
Wow.
It's such a weird thing. And it's like, yeah, as I was reflecting on this exact concept of, like, you need to make room for the people coming up. You need to pass this canon to the next generation. How many kids growing up today, like the six-year-olds of today, how many of them have never seen a newspaper? You know, like, they've seen them around.
Yeah.
But, like, this experience of having the newspaper come to your house and sitting around and reading it is foreign to a lot of them, I think.
I was, like, I spent a lot of time around kids, and I would say that anytime I do, like, occasionally I'll do, like, an informal poll, like, what kind of comics do you read? And a surprising number of kids do still read comics and newspapers, like way more than I would have expected. And I assume it's only kids whose parents happen to get a newspaper, and that number has got to be shrinking. So, I mean, those numbers are going down, and, like, these kids aren't going to ever have a newspaper subscription. But the numbers aren't at zero yet.
Okay, interesting. Thank you for that cultural update.
Yeah.
Like, I do think that kids who have access to graphic novels are generally way more excited about them than about newspaper comics. Even the kids who, like, Garfield is their favorite comic, I'm pretty sure they're reading Garfield in, like, the graphic novel collection. They're waiting for the trades.
They're waiting for the trades. Yeah. But, like, I mean, why wouldn't you? I don't know if you've heard about graphic novels, but if you're interested in an interesting sample of, like, all the great graphic novels that are out there, you should check out the trade winners.
We've got a lot to pick from.
I mean, it's just kind of a cultural shift, right? I mean, I feel it's sort of like Sunday comics, in a way, are the same as, like, the, you know, TV shows from the 80s that led up to these commercial breaks, like, and so you watch them, watch them ad-free online, and you're like, why did everything build to a tension point after the first 15 minutes and then de-escalate down and then build up again for another 15 minutes? It's like, oh, because we got to get you to the commercial break, and then we're acting like we're recapping what just happened, because clearly you haven't just seen this stuff a minute ago. You've had this time now to digest that first 15 minutes, and now we gotta remind you what just happened. And, like, now you've got Netflix, where the whole premise is like, well, obviously you're just going to watch like 8 hours of the show, like, back to back.
Yeah, the binge watch is it's a really interesting shift in the medium of television, which we could talk for hours about.
I think that relates a little bit to comics. Like, I mean, Calvin and Hobbes was these little bite-sized comics that you experienced one every week, or a little, like, four-panel strip a day, it was doled out in these little tiny portions. It wasn't designed to be this... Like, Bill Watterson wasn't imagining a giant hardcover book on a table that some kid was going to pore over. He was imagining it as these little nuggets that would come out with a newspaper.
That experience is not dead. Mm. That experience has just changed. Mm. So, like, I spent a long time in webcomics. Like, webcomics very much was about that relationship that you had with the readers. You were producing content on a regular basis, and they would check in to follow along with your work. Like, that was a similar kind of bite-sized experience. And now I've noticed it move very much into Webtoon.
Yes.
Webtoon, where it's on your mobile phone, and it just, like, pings you. And it's like, oh, now it's time to experience this little bite-sized thing of this thing I'm following. Well, so I think the bite-sized aspect still exists. It's just, like, it's changing a lot, and it's changing quickly, and it's going to be interesting to see where it goes.
Like, a lot of newspaper comics, quote-unquote newspaper comics, have readerships exclusively online as well, where the syndicates have their own websites where, like, all the comics managed by the syndicate are on the site, and you go to the site, and you can catch up on your latest comics. You could check every day if you want, and there'll be a new comic. So that's interesting, too. All right, I have a question here that I want to ask, because before we run out of time. And I'm framing this as a question because I think I know what my answers would be, but I'm not sure. Like, I want to get some input, some feedback on this.
Okay.
So part of the essay at the start of this book is about licensing.
And famously, I knew this was going to come up.
Famously, Calvin and Hobbes has never been licensed for anything other than these books. I wonder if maybe even getting these books made was a push at the start. But thank goodness that they did, because otherwise it would all be gone and forgotten.
Yeah.
But anyways, so he goes through, Bill Watterson goes through his reasons for not wanting to license Calvin and Hobbes, and the fight he had to go through because he signed a contract saying he would, and then he didn't want to, and his syndicate didn't want to piss him off, and he threatened to quit if they did license everything. And so anyways, part of this, I'm going to read this. It says, the world of a comic strip is much more fragile than most people realize or will admit. Believable characters are hard to develop and easy to destroy. When a cartoonist licenses his characters, his voice is co-opted by the business concerns of toy makers, television producers, and advertisers. The cartoonist's job is no longer to be an original thinker. His job is to keep his characters profitable. The characters become celebrities, endorsing companies and products, avoiding controversy, and saying whatever someone will pay them to say. At that point, the strip has no soul. With its integrity gone, a strip loses its deeper significance. So I have, I guess, two questions about that. One is, do you think his plan was successful? Do you think that your perception of Calvin and Hobbes as characters would be different if there were five Calvin and Hobbes movies and plush toys and stickers and everything else?
I think it would have changed things. I think when he makes the observation of, like, I had no interest in a toy company answering the question of Hobbes's reality by producing Hobbes plushies, I sort of see where he's coming from. That being said, I mean, I've seen a lot of Calvin and Hobbes bootleg merchandise. I've seen people who've stitched their own Hobbes dolls together, and I don't think that detracts, but then I think it also is different. It's different when it's somebody making this stuff out of an act of love of the characters. They're bootlegging it because they just love it. It's a little different than, like, when you go to a Dairy Queen and, like, all the Peanuts characters are like, buy a a new sundae we're offering. Like, it does feel a little odd when, like, your cartoon characters are selling you stuff versus just telling you a story. And I think that, considering his approach to the strip, I can see why he sees that as affecting the timelessness or the whatever it is he was trying to go for with Calvin and Hobbes.
I think that the values that Bill Watterson holds about the integrity of this work and the integrity of maintaining Calvin and Hobbes as characters are valid. I think that that should be the right of the artist to decide what their boundary is, right? You know, it's like, I've definitely encountered this within my own work. It's like, I've noticed that while I don't hold as strong a stance with, like, no merchandising ever, especially when I was writing Autobio, there were boundaries of what I was willing to put, like, my literal face on, you know? And it's like, that should be the discretion of the artist. That being said, when you reread that passage, it was really interesting to me because it recalled kind of what we're going through right now with cartooning and meme culture and the ownership of the artist and, like, taking an image and co-opting it for some nebulous purpose, right? You know, it's very often that a meme image will get removed from its original context and twisted to mean something else, and that is removed from the control of the artist. And I feel like it does remove the soul of,
like,
the work.
Pepe the Frog.
Pepe is a huge example. The one that calls to mind for me is Question Hound, which is the This Is Fine Dog.
Oh, yeah.
Question Hound has a canon of his own. You know, like, he was a pre-existing character in Casey Green's work. And, like, when you take This Is Fine out of the context of the rest of the comic, it's different. You know, not that it's necessarily diluted to the point of, like, I think it still evokes something that obviously resonates, but it still does remove it from Casey Green's artistic voice and artistic vision.
Yeah, and I think, as someone who has only seen the meme and hasn't read the comic it's from, I think if I went back and read that comic, my perception of it would be very different than if I came to it cold.
Yeah, and yeah, sort of like, in a way, Bill Watterson avoided that by sort of, he shut everything down before the internet really took off, so you don't see his work being as co-opted. But I mean, at the same time, he wouldn't have any control at this point. If someone wanted to
Well, this is the Calvin peeing on blank on the back of tracks, which he does reference in here. Yeah. So that's a meme.
Yeah.
And, like, he didn't have any defense against that.
Right.
But he sort of kind of questions, like, maybe if I had, like, licensed some things, that this would have stamped out that. I don't think it would have. I think people would have had that bootleg sticker regardless.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure. It's impossible to say.
This is true. So then I guess my second part of this was, I was going to ask, like, I think you're right, Angela, that it's the right of the artist to decide how and when their work gets licensed, and I think that's the only ethical approach. So I'm just curious, where would you draw your line? Like, where From your perspective of your work, I don't think any of us would necessarily draw the line in exactly the same place as Bill Watterson. I'm just curious, where would you put your line?
That's a tough one. I mean, I would say that I think Bill Watterson is maybe... Well, I mean, I think at the time period, he was probably more correct. I would say in 2018, the idea that you would completely lose your character to a TV producer or a toy manufacturer isn't necessarily true. Like, I think, you know, there, like, you look at, say, like, Todd McFarlane, who took all of his creative ideas and made a toy company where he was, like, making toys to his own standard, his own spec. And this is his vision now turned into a toy to his quality standards. And he controlled that. And I think when we've dealt with a lot of the comics we've covered have been adapted into movies and TV series. And, like, I mean, I Kill Giants, the writer was involved in the production of that movie. So, I mean, I think that if you want to, you can be an active participant in the licensing of your work, and you can have that control. You can carry the same, like, you won't be able to micromanage it quite the same way on the page, but you can definitely have influence on how your character is represented in other medium if you want to put in that work. And I definitely would, I mean, there's definitely going to be, like, a lot of work that I wouldn't want to do. And so maybe for that reason, I would have some boundaries of just, like, oh, it's just not worth the stress. But, like, I mean, for example, if, like, I read Fortune and Glory by Brian Michael Bendis about his comic getting optioned for film. And with each of his books being optioned, he was given the opportunity to write the first draft of the script. And if I was offered a chance to, like, adapt one of my works into, like, a screenplay for a movie, I would probably, if I was allowed to write at least the first draft and maybe be involved in that development, I would say yes. If they were like, we just want to take this character and run with it and you just sit on the sidelines, then no, I wouldn't. So, I mean, a lot of it would be, I'd have a lot of questions before I could answer some of these things. I mean, if it was stuff that I'm producing, if I was producing my own merch, like making t-shirts of my characters, like, I'm overseeing that, then I would be okay with that. But maybe handing that off to someone else, I might not be as comfortable. So, I mean, really, it's about how much control I would get.
What do you think, Jeff?
Okay, I famously hate movies, which is not entirely true. I watch lots of movies. But I haven't seen enough good movie adaptations of things that I like that I would trust anyone in Hollywood to adapt something I'd written as a movie. So I think that would be my limit. That, and I definitely wouldn't want an adaptation to be made of something that I haven't finished. Like, if it's a multi-volume series and I haven't finished the ending yet, I don't think anybody, including myself, should be trying to turn that into something else, because that's not the whole story yet.
You don't want HBO to write the ending to your epic series?
Like, I think lots of other things might be on the table. It would depend on what it was. I think t-shirts are cool. I like t-shirts. But, and I don't know, other adaptations in other media, even maybe. I don't think Hollywood, anyone in Hollywood would have the same goals as I would.
I have different opinions about different works that I've made. So to me, it's very work specific. I have very clear answers about Wasted Talent because I went through that, you know, like, and I discovered those very clear boundaries. I was willing to put an image of myself on a mug. That was probably the farthest I was willing to go. So a limited edition mug, quantity 100, that was it. I'm totally happy to create books. Prints are fine. I did not want to make t-shirts with my likeness or the likeness of anyone in the comic. Those are real people. Those are myself. And it was just too weird. Same thing with plushes. Too weird. Stickers, no. So I've never made a sticker of myself, with the exception of the highly pixelated version that's barely even a picture of me. So, like, until it got really, really, really abstract, I wasn't comfortable doing it. The stuff that I merchandised from Wasted Talent was a lot more one-off and abstract and cartoony. Like, the bee, like, I just drew a weird-looking bee one day. And because it was so removed from my life, I was very comfortable making merchandise of that bee. I made a USB stick. I made a bunch of stickers. Like, I made... If I thought I could have sold some plushes, I think it would have